Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Herbie, let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Hello, everyone. I'm Kenny Williams, the Executive Vice President for the Chicago White Sox. On behalf of the White Sox organization and me personally, I would like to say congratulations and happy anniversary to the Negro League Museum and all the people responsible for making it such a success it is today and continuing the legacy. In 2005, we were fortunate enough to win the World Series here in Chicago, and for that I received the Rube Foster Executive of the Year Award in Kansas City at the museum. I promised Bob Kendrick that the world champions the next year would come to the doorstep of the museum, and when we filed off that bus, you should have seen the look in his face. Thank you all for the years of continuing the legacy, for educating the youth and the not so youthful, but at this time, I think a simple tip of the hat says it all. So again, congratulations, happy anniversary.
I really like that Kenny Williams has been more visible and more vocal over the last few weeks. I think that's a voice that we need out here in these baseball streets right now. Bob Kendrick is terrific. He's the president of the Negro Leagues Museum in Kansas City. They open back up on the 16th. I want to talk with Bob about that. He's nice enough to join me on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford Melrose Park has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from. You can go to alpamonteford.com. It is our pleasure to bring back Bob Kendrick here to the show. Mr. Kendrick, how are you, sir?
Lawrence, man, I'm great. Thanks for having me back on. And, you know, it was great to hear Kenny's tip your cap salute because that's one of the great moments. I remember that moment in time like it was yesterday, because he did promise. He promised myself and he promised the late, great Buck O'Neill when we handed him the Rube Foster Executive of the Year Award that he was going to bring the world champion Chicago White Sox back to the Negro Leagues Museum. And he fulfilled that promise. And to this day, he's the only one to bring an entire major league team. Now, there have been others who have brought big groups, but he had the entire team come out. And I would imagine there were some guys who came kicking and screaming because, you know, they wanted to, I'm sure, do other things. But once they got there, they were enamored by what they experienced here. And my fondest memory of all of that, Jose Contreras was with the club at that time. And when Jose Contreras walked in and saw his fellow countryman in the form of a life-size statue, the great Martin de Higo, who hailed from Cuba, El Maestro, they called him, because he could do it all, played all nine positions, played all nine of them well, is the only ball player in the history of our sport to be enshrined in five different countries' baseball halls of fame, Mexican, Cuban, Venezuelan, Dominican, and in Cooperstown. Well, Jose lit up and was filled with pride as he realized this connection that he had to the Negro Leagues. And so the White Sox organization, Kenny Williams, holds a very special place in my heart.
Can we talk a little bit about Buck O'Neill? And here's why I ask, Bob. Like, we usually use Buck O'Neill as kind of a reference point. But I want to talk about the player and the man. You knew him really well. What was Buck O'Neill like, and what was it like to have him share stories with you about playing in the league?
It was special. It was special, and he became obviously a dear friend of mine, a confidant, a mentor, and I got to work shoulder to shoulder with him for so many years before we lost him in 2006 at the age of 94. But you're right, because most of the time when we talk about Buck O'Neill is in reference to, and sometimes people lose sight that Buck had been a prominent player in the Negro Leagues, came to Kansas City from the Memphis Red Sox. He came to Kansas City in 1938 to play first base for the great Kansas City Monarchs and had a long-standing affiliation with this great city from 1938 until he died in 2006. But from 38 to 55, he was a member of the Kansas City Monarchs as a great first baseman player, then would eventually become a player manager. He left the Monarchs after the 1955 season and migrated to Chicago, where he spent many years working for the Cubs organization. And he went to become a scout for the Cubs. And, of course, as a scout, he signed Hall of Famers Ernie Banks, Lou Brock, and then most recent Hall of Famer Lee Arthur Smith to their first professional contracts. And then, of course, he also signed another guy who spent time in Chicago, Joe Carter, who we hope will have an opportunity to eventually become a Hall of Famer as well. And then Buck would go on to become a barrier breaker himself by becoming the major's first African-American coach in 1962 with the Chicago Cubs. And then really, Lawrence, became the voice of the Negro Leagues. This epic narration of Ken Burns' documentary on baseball really kind of stole the show. You know, I tell people all the time, you have this very charming, gentle man who was telling these wonderful stories to baseball fans that they had never heard before. And he did it with a twinkle in his eye and a smile that lit up the screen, and America fell in love with Buck O'Neill. He was 82 years old at that time, and he would always tell me, he says, "Oh, Bob, I've been telling these stories for 40 years, and nobody ever listened." Ken Burns gave him a platform, and people listened. And he was, God blessed him to live another 12 years where he was literally gallivanting all over this country, preaching the gospel of the Negro Leagues and the virtues of his museum, the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, to any and everybody who would listen. And there I was right there on his coattail, you know, shouting amen at every corner, you know, being there for the ride, being there for the ride. But you mentioned something. I now get to tell the stories that he shared. And Lawrence, every time I tell one of those stories, I feel like it keeps him alive in my mind and in my heart. And we don't want these stories to ever fade away. And they're such a big part of the Negro Leagues experience, and not only Buck's stories, but the stories that I got to hear firsthand from Minnie Minoso, another great Chicagoan who spent so many years there on the South Side, or Monty Irvin, or all of the countless Negro League players that I've gotten an opportunity to meet through the years. And so I take a part of each and every one of them to make this story come to life through those stories that we share. I didn't live them like they did, but I did get them firsthand.
For the 100th anniversary of the Negro Leagues, the Tip Your Cap campaign, who came up with it, and why did you want it to go off?
Well, man, I can tell you now, I'd be lying if I told you that I thought it was going to take off the way that it took off. You could only hope, and I don't even know if we could have in my wildest dreams foreseen what we saw over the last 2 weeks, and particularly yesterday with four U.S. presidents tipping their cap, and Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Billie Jean King and Bob Costas. The list just goes on and on of notables who joined us in this effort. And so, as you know, this was the centennial, and it is the centennial year for the Negro Leagues, and coronavirus derailed so many of our plans, just as it has hampered other businesses in this country. And so we were looking for a way to try and re-energize this celebration as baseball was getting ready to come back. And so I came up with this crazy idea to do a virtual tip your cap to the Negro Leagues. And so I went to my good friend, the great writer, Joe Posnanski, as I do with many of my crazy ideas, and said, hey, man, I got a crazy idea. What do you think? Well, he didn't think it was a crazy idea. He went to his business partner, who is a tremendous communication strategist, Dan McGinn, and he didn't think it was a crazy idea. And the three of us then set in motion to try and see if we could get as many fans, athletes, entertainers, dignitaries, political business leaders to just simply acknowledge the Negro League with the tip of the cap on the occasion of the 100th anniversary.
I'm trying to decide which one of my caps I'm going to use. I think I might use my Homestead Gray cap or my Chicago American Giants cap. But I'm going to definitely put a video and be a part of the movement. Bob, a texter asked a great question, because whenever we think about Ernie Banks, obviously we think about Ernie Banks in a Cubs uniform because he's one of the greatest players that's ever played for the Cubs organization. But he also had a history inside the Negro League. So what was Ernie Banks' connection with the Negro Leagues in Kansas City?
Played right here for the great Kansas City Monarchs. Buck O'Neill was his manager. The legendary Cool Papa Bell discovers Ernie Banks playing in Dallas. And Bill Blair, the late, great Bill Blair, was also there. And Cool Papa Bell calls Buck O'Neill and says, I got somebody here for you. And Buck O'Neill signs Ernie Banks basically sight unseen by the recommendation of the legendary Cool Papa Bell. But you think about this. If Cool Papa Bell says you can play, you must can play. And so Ernie comes to Kansas City. And if Ernie Banks was alive today, he'll tell you that he owes his baseball career to Buck O'Neill, who mentored him. And then when Buck comes over to Chicago, Buck had a hand in mentoring all of those black players, and he was responsible for bringing so many of them to the Cubs. But when Ernie was here, he loved his time playing with Kansas City Monarchs, and he stayed at the Street Hotel, which used to be right down the street from where the museum operates. And guess who his roommate was?
Who?
His roommate was the great Elston Howard, the first black.
Get out of here!
Yeah. No, and Ernie says the two of them, because you got to remember that this is now after Jackie has broken the color barrier, that the two of them would sit up in their hotel room at night and they would talk about which one of them would get to the major leagues first. So they were all dreaming at that time of the possibility of playing in the major leagues, because it wasn't a pipe dream now. It was real because Jackie had made it real. And as it turns out, Ernie would get there before Elston, but both of them would have great careers. You know, Elston had so much of his career cut short because he was toiling in the Yankees minor league system because they converted him to a catcher. And of course, Yogi Berra was your catcher, so you never were going to get a chance to play. But when Elston does come up to the Yankees, he became the heart and soul of those Yankee teams. But both of those legendary ball players were part of the great Kansas City Monarchs. And so Ernie's roots are deep as it relates to the Negro League.
I had someone request you talking about Moses Fleetwood Walker, because this is a guy that was breaking barriers even before Jackie Robinson was.
Yeah, no, and there were other examples of black players playing on white teams, and Edward White even before Moses Fleetwood Walker. There was Bud Fowler, but Moses Fleetwood Walker was kind of noted for being that first to play on what we would call a major league team. This is in the late 1800s. Moses Fleetwood Walker, y'all, was a barehanded catcher. Ouch.
Yeah,
it didn't last very long before guys like Adrian
Catanzan,
who spent time there in Chicago, and others would form, quote-unquote, a gentleman's agreement that would ultimately ban black players from playing on white professional teams. The thing that strikes me, Lawrence, is that was never any written doctrine. It was just a verbal agreement that essentially said, if you allow a black to play with you, you can't play with us. Well, Anson was so good. Yeah, Cap Anson is in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. It was pretty easy for him to build a coalition of followers who shared that same sentiment. Moses Fleetwood Walker was barred, and that would at least centrally ban black players for the next six decades until Jackie Robinson would ultimately break the color barrier in 1947, but there were other African-American pioneers even prior to Jackie Robinson.
I want to ask you about Roberto Clemente. And the reason I want to ask you is because I feel like he's such a great connector. He's a great connector to the rich history of Puerto Rican baseball. But he made it very clear, I am a black Puerto Rican. And I think that there is a lot of value in that when we talk about the African diaspora. What did people tell you about Clemente and the way that he played the game?
Well, it was influenced by the Negro Leagues. And as Negro League players would go to his native Puerto Rico to play and were celebrated there, just as they were when they went to many Spanish-speaking countries. When they would go to those countries, Lawrence, they were treated like heroes. They stayed in the finest hotels. They ate in the finest restaurants that those countries had to offer, come back home, and you're treated like a second-class citizen. Well, Roberto Clemente saw so many of these great players play, you know, and for Puerto Rico, there was a guy named Willard Brown. Willard Brown is in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. He played here for the Kansas City Monarchs, but he won the Triple Crown in Puerto Rico twice, and the fans nicknamed him Ese Hombre, that man. He was just as beloved by the older Puerto Rican baseball fan as Roberto Clemente was. But Roberto Clemente idolized the great Monty Irvin. And Roberto Clemente Jr. told me that Monty Irvin, that his dad used to carry Monty Irvin's uniform to the ballpark. And see, if you carried the player's uniform, he was going to let you in the game for free. And that Monty Irvin gave his dad his first real baseball glove. And he patterned his game after the great Monty Irvin. But people forget that Monty Irvin was a superstar in the Negro Leagues. Yeah, if Major League Baseball had gotten Monty Irvin when he was 20, 21 years old, Lawrence, there was nothing he couldn't do. See, Monty doesn't get to the Major Leagues until he's 30 years old, and he still has a fabulous Major League career. But in the Negro Leagues, Monty could do everything that you could do on a baseball diamond, and he had the great looks. He had everything that you needed. He had star quality written all over him, man. And Roberto Clemente idolized him. And as fate would have it, the two of them are inducted in the Hall of Fame on the same day. Of course, Roberto had passed away in that tragic plane accident. And Mrs. Clemente, Vera Clemente, accepted his Hall of Fame plaque. But the two, his childhood idol, they go into the Hall of Fame on the same day. And as I tell people all the time, every hero has a hero. There's somebody that motivated you that you wanted to emulate and be like. And for the great Roberto Clemente, one of the greatest Major League Baseball players of all time, it was former Negro League star Monty Irvin.
I love that saying. I'm writing that down. Every hero had a hero. So Bob Kendrick, of the president of the Negro Leagues Museum, joining me here. Before you got to know Buck O'Neill and all of these great legends of the Negro League, who was your hero? Who was the ball player that you gravitated towards?
Henry Aaron, and he still is. He still is. No, Henry Aaron is my all-time favorite baseball player. And, you know, outside of my father, who was my first hero. But when we talk about sports, it's Henry Aaron. And he's still my favorite person to have toured through the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, because I'm always reduced to that almost 12-year-old kid that circled the bases in my mother's living room. When he hit record home run 715, I'm circling the bases in a little bitty Crawfordville, Georgia, 80 miles east of Atlanta. I'm circling the bases in her living room. And so the couch was first base. The old TV was second base. She had another old couch that was third base, and her recliner was home plate. And so as my childhood idol was touching them all in Atlanta, Fulton County Stadium, I'm touching them all in my mother's living room, jumping for joy. And so I'm reduced to that 12-year-old kid every time I'm around him. And so we had the chance to tour him through the museum for the first time in 1999. And, Lawrence, it's the only time I've ever been starstruck in my life. And we've had some remarkable people tour this museum. And with no disrespect to any of them, two American presidents in Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, former first ladies, Laura Bush, Michelle Obama, General Colin Powell, the list goes on. And with no disrespect to any of them, they not Henry Aaron in my eyes. And so,
so Bob, you can bring a president in here if you want to, but he ain't Henry Aaron.
You know, and so taking him on that tour of the museum was, man, just one of the most incredible moments for me. The admiration and respect that I have for him. And at that time, they were celebrating 25 years of him breaking his record. And I don't know if your audience is familiar with his story as well, because time passes. He was getting death threats as he was chasing Ruth's record. His family is in hiding when he breaks Ruth's record. He doesn't know if he's going to make it around the bases. That's how polarized our country was, and this is 1974. You know what I'm saying? And so the things that we're seeing now, this is still just kind of a continuation of, and it took him 25 years before he finally got to exhale and celebrate what many thought to be the most remarkable sports accomplishment of all time. And so it was an incredible moment for me, for this museum, to take Henry Aaron on a tour of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. But everybody knew when we were playing Sandlot Baseball, there was no debate. I'm going to be Henry Aaron. Can't nobody else be Henry Aaron but me.
All right. So we know that now, from now on, that if you're ever hanging out with Bob Kendrick, he's Hank Aaron, and that's it. And as we were talking, I went back and looked over the video to see all the people that are in the Tip Your Cap 2020 campaign on MLB's site, and to see Henry Aaron there, God, it just makes you feel good.
Oh, man, it does. I mean, you know, like I said, he's an amazing human being who just happened to be a great baseball player, and his roots began, of course, in the Negro Leagues with the Indianapolis Clowns in 1952. He comes to the Negro Leagues as an 18-year-old skinny cross-handed hitting infielder. He may have weighed, Lawrence, 150 pounds soaking wet at that time. And he comes to the Indianapolis Clowns in 1952. When he gets to the Clowns, they put the right hand on top, and the rest is history. And again, I tell people all the time, you take away all 755 home runs, Henry Aaron still has over 3,000 hits. His RBI record will likely never be broken. So I don't know if a Hall of Famer can be underrated, but if so, he's probably one of the most underrated Hall of Famers there is, because – you know, he doesn't get all the credit he deserves for how well he played defense, because he played a corner outfield and not the middle. He didn't play center field. And so that distinction typically goes to the center fielder. That's why people love Willie Mays. And in the Negro Leagues, Oscar Charleston, Cool Papa Bell. They played center field. That's that glamour defensive position.
Bob, I have someone asking. It's a really interesting question. I'd love to know what you think about it. The connection between jazz and the Negro Leagues.
Oh, it's huge. It is huge. And it comes to life at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So when you walk through the Negro Leagues Museum, I think it was important for us to help people understand how the Negro Leagues impacted other aspects of black culture. And so when you walk through the Negro Leagues Museum, there's an area that depicts the street hotel, the sitting room of the street hotel. And I tell people all the time, you could walk into the sitting room and you might see sitting in one of those chairs former heavyweight boxing champion Joe Louis, or the fastest man in the world, Jesse Owens, although Jesse Owens would never race Cool Papa Bell, flat out refused to race Cool Papa Bell. Lawrence, Jesse Owens would race horses around the bases, but never Cool Papa Bell.
Okay, so that's a story I didn't know. I didn't know that Jesse Owens wasn't going to race Cool Papa Bell. I kind of love that.
He refused to race Cool Papa. Yeah, and then, but you would also see these elements of jazz, because you will see images of Lionel Hampton surrounded by members of the Kansas City Monarchs. Hampton loved the Monarchs, the great vibraphonist. Yeah, he loved the Monarchs, so much so that Buck O'Neill would put Hampton in a Monarch uniform. He'd sit on the bench and serve as an honorary coach. There are images of Lena Horne throwing out the first pitch at an All-Star game. The great jazz artist Cab Calloway had his own semi-pro black baseball team. So did Louis Armstrong. As a matter of fact, General Colin Powell, when he visited the museum, told me that his father played for Louis Armstrong's semi-pro team called the Armstrong Secret Nine. based out of New Orleans, as they would say. And so, interestingly enough, all the jazz musicians wanted to be baseball players. All the baseball players wanted to be jazz musicians. So it was only fitting that they would come together here in Kansas City, where you had the best of both worlds, jazz and baseball radiating from this one street corner where the museum operates now, historic 18th and Vine. Oh, man, the place was jumping. It was a cultural crossroads. And again, they were both traveling the same circuit. As then they called it the Chitlin Circuit. Yeah, they were supporting each other. So by day, the jazz musician would come watch these athletes do their thing in the Negro Leagues, and then by night, the Negro League players would go watch them do their thing. One of my favorite stories, if we got time, Buck O'Neill tells a story. The Monarchs had played a game here in Kansas City on a Saturday night. They were all going to go home and come back here to historic 18th and Vine and go to a nightclub, meet at a nightclub called the Subway. Well, it was called the Subway, Lawrence, because it was literally below street level. And so Buck says everybody's in the club sipping on a little tea. When in walks a kid, got a horn over his shoulder, he wants to blow. Everybody says, let him blow. Buck said a kid gets up on the stage. He's making some noises out of his horn they'd never heard before, but you had to pay attention. That kid was 17-year-old Charlie Yardbird Parker, who went to high school right up the hill from where the museum is at Lincoln High School. That's the kind of star power that was there in that era of black baseball. And that's why this story is so incredibly rich and so incredibly special.
Wow, that is – okay, marking that one down to do more research on, too. The museum's back open, right? You're doing some stuff?
2 weeks, celebrating 2 weeks of being back open today, as a matter of fact. We opened June 16th. I can't tell you. We were closed for 3 months, and it's lifted everybody's spirit to have this place back open and have life back in it, even though we're operating on, obviously, some very stringent COVID-19 guidelines – protocols that we had to implement. Our capacity has been reduced. We had to make some operational procedure changes and that kind of thing, but it's lifted everybody's spirit to just have life back in this place again. And I was joking half-heartedly, really. The first visitor was from Brooklyn, New York. A young lady, her and her husband were driving through Kansas City, and she wanted to stop and see the Negro Leagues Museum. And for me, Lawrence, it was like a publisher's clearinghouse moment, man. I wanted the balloons and the confetti, everything to drop, everything except now I ain't had no check for it, but it was so exciting.
Well, Bob, I'm happy that the museum doors are back open and that you are able to share that feeling with everyone. NLBM.com. If you want to learn more, if you'd like to donate to the museum, you are a treasure, Bob Kendrick, and I appreciate that you have time.
Hey, man, anytime. And everybody, don't forget, take your photograph, take your video, load it up to photos at tippingyourcap.com and be part of the movement to pay honor and respect to the Negro Leagues on the 100th anniversary of the birth of the Negro Leagues.
I love that. Thank you, sir, for your time. I appreciate it.
Anytime, Lawrence, man. It's great to catch up. Thank you so much.
I feel the same way. That is Bob Kendrick. I almost swore on the air when he told the Charlie Parker story. And I mean one of the ones that would get you in trouble. Because I almost said, get the out of here. Holy crap. Bob Kendrick is amazing. I'm glad you got a chance to hear him. Our buddy Jason Leisure has been going through a whole bunch of baseball cards. He's got stuff. I want to talk to him about it next here on The Score.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with 3 rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.